This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The celebrated writer André Debussy died Wednesday of a heart attack at the age of 62. Today we remember him with a 1991 interview. Debussy's life was divided into two parts, before and after the accident. On a summer night in 1986, he was driving along a highway near Boston when he spotted a woman standing beside her car, which was stopped in the third lane. He pulled off the side of the road to see if anyone was hurt. The woman was bleeding and crying. She and her brother had hit a motorcycle. As the three tried to flag down more help, they were struck by an oncoming car. The brother was killed. The sister was uninjured. Debussy was crippled by the accident. He lost one leg and lost all use of the other. In the aftermath, he had about a dozen operations. His marriage ended. He had financial trouble and a bad case of writer's block. But when he started publishing again, old and new work, he developed a larger audience and was met with critical acclaim. When I spoke with him, he read the opening of a piece about the accident called Lights of the Long Night.
I remember the headlights, but I do not remember the car hitting Luis Santiago and me, and I do not remember the sounds our bodies made. Luis died, either in the ambulance or later that night in the hospital. He was 23 years old. I do not remember leaving the ground my two legs stood on for the last instant in my life, then moving through the air, over the car's hood and windshield and roof, and falling on his trunk. I remember lying on my back on that trunk and asking someone what happened. I did not lose consciousness. The car did not injure my head or my neck or my spine. It broke my right hand and scraped both arms near my wrists, so my wife believes I covered my face with my arms as I fell. I lay for a while on the trunk talking to a young man, then to a woman who is a state trooper. Then I was in an ambulance, stopped on the highway, talking to a state trooper, a man, while he cut my trousers and my right western boot. That morning, my wife saw the left boot on the side of the highway while she was driving home from the hospital in Boston. The car had knocked it off my foot. The state troopers got the boot from my wife, but I did not leave the hospital with a left foot or, below the middle of my knee, a left leg.
You know, one of the reasons why I asked you to read that story instead of asking you to tell it is that I thought you might feel almost tired of telling the story about what happened to you.
I am.
Are you?
You know, 5 years I've been telling that story. Actually, I don't know if I ever, well, you know, in the first few years it used to scare me and had to take a Xanax to tell it. And now.
It used to scare you just to tell a story?
Yeah.
And have you told it enough so that it's just a story now? I mean,
actually, I told it to some teenage girls I was teaching. This was only last fall. Ooh. I had a new girl that night. She asked what happened, and another girl started telling her because I didn't want to. But the other girl wasn't telling it right, so I told it. And when they left, I got very anxious, yeah, and I did, in fact, take a tranquilizer and then go check with a psychologist to see if what was happening was what I thought was happening.
Which was what?
I said, you know, they left, I started to pay bills, and I started getting very anxious, and I wondered what was wrong. And then I thought, well, you've just told a story about almost getting killed and told it at night, which I usually try to avoid doing, and it's messed you up.
Why is it harder to tell it at night?
Oh, I think it has to do with darkness and death. When I got home from the hospital in 86, in September, I got frightened every day at sunset and took a Xanax when the sun went down. And always assumed, no one's told me any different, that, you know, that, well, it's because I almost died. And I didn't like seeing the sun go down. And to this day, I sleep with my bedroom door open and all the shades up, because that not being, being closed in reminds me of the hospital, where there were windows, but, you know, they looked out over an alley. So, I mean, you know, there was window looking onto brick without much light.
Right.
I think so. I mean, you know, I was close.
This is the story of the moment that's probably most changed your life. And it's probably the story you've told the most, at least in the past few years. And I'm wondering how the telling of the story has changed over time.
It hasn't really changed much. Since writing that, I've come to terms with the lives of the other people involved. In other words, I've done some forgiving, which was necessary, especially of the driver who ran over us. And, of course, she should be forgiven. It was only an accident, but, you know, I took it personally for about 8 or 9 months. But basically, the story hasn't changed. But as I get now nearly 5 years from it, I'm even more deeply grateful and awed because I've heard since then of so many other accidents. Grateful and awed that I was struck by a fast-moving vehicle on a highway and emerged as healthy as I did.
So when you met the driver...
No, I never...
You never met the driver?
No, I never met her. I was brought up in Catholic school, so I learned as a little boy, you know, to pray for people you don't like. And I started doing that for her, using her name, because I really felt hatred, and I knew the only way to get rid of it was praying. And I never felt good about it when I was praying, but finally, after a few months... with some help from somebody else who was actually praying with me, I saw it from the woman's point of view.
In asking you about the telling of the story and how you tell it and how the telling has changed, I think one of the things I'm trying to find out is if you've tried to find a way of telling the story so that what people feel isn't pity but a larger sense of the fragility of life. Do you know what I mean? Like... there's ways of telling stories so that people feel sorry for you, and there's other ways of telling it so that they feel something larger than that.
Well, every time I tell it to somebody, it's always with awe and gratitude. I've met a lot of injured people since my injury because of the mutual help that we go for. And everyone I know who's crippled has used the word gratitude and grateful because what happened to us was bad enough to have made things worse, you know. So that's always the way I remember it. Well, I remember it with fear, too. And I never lost consciousness. A nurse told me no one ever remembers the point of impact, but I know two injured people who do, and I'm hoping that I never remember that.
Yeah, don't you think it's a blessing to not remember
I think it's
that?
A great blessing. I remember the headlights, and then I remember being on her trunk and then learning that I never lost consciousness. So my eyes must have seen, you know, that grill and hood and windshield coming, and I'm just very glad I don't remember that.
Now, you're a very literary man. I mean, you read a lot, you write a lot. And we know all about tragedy and the way people react to, you know, horrible things in their lives from literature, but that doesn't stop us from having to experience it when it happens to us. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
I do. It doesn't save you from anything. Did you feel that, like, what you knew from literature, from, like, the greatest writing that you'd read, helped you in any way?
Oh, yes, I do. I do. I think if I had been younger and had a different background, I may have had a worse response, or even older with a different background. Growing up with in Christian Brothers schools, as I did, which were Catholic schools, growing up with the Passion of Christ as your example of this is how things are going to be, gives you the expectation of suffering. And then... You know, I started reading serious literature when I was about 18, and most of that is about what? People who love each other, people who hurt each other, people who lose. And so you could say I've been spending most of my spiritual and mental life dealing with suffering of others, from Christ to Natasha in War and Peace, right?
Has your reading changed in recent years?
Has my reading changed? Yeah. I tend to read more of the New Testament and less of anything else. The first year of my injury, I didn't notice it until someone said to me, what are you reading? And I said, I'm only reading the New Testament and histories of Marines. And the guy said, well, that makes sense. And then I realized I was doing both for my spirit, trying to get courage, endurance, grace, patience, wisdom.
What did the history of the Marines give you?
Oh, vivid examples of people suffering and enduring and, you know, having true grit and resilience. I was in the Marines, so I needed, you know, I was never in the Marines in war, but, you know, I needed that spirit. It became very important to me after I got run over.
We're listening to a 1991 interview with writer Andre Dubuis, who died this week. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1991 interview with writer Andre Dubuis, who died of a heart attack this week at the age of 62. He was crippled in a freak accident in 1986. How long did it take you to start writing again after the accident?
Oof. I'm still working on that. I have been writing. I wrote 10 of those essays. I've written 4 stories. I got hit in July. I wrote a very short story in January. I was trying to write in the hospital. So I've always been writing since the accident. But it's been very difficult to create something whole. And I'm starting to understand now in my 5th year that the healing is long. I mean, people have told me this all along, that the body, the spirit, the mind are all damaged and everything's going to come back slowly. But I'm starting to believe it now.
So is it mostly physical distress that's held you back from writing more?
I don't really know. Only in the past few weeks, this May, I've begun to feel some energy and peace that I have never felt since being hurt in 86. Begun to feel even almost like I used to feel, as well as I remember how I used to feel. On Thanksgiving of 86, Tobias Wolff, that wonderful, wonderful writer and friend, phoned me. I was still in a cast. I was home. I was hurting. And as soon as he said, this is Toby, I started crying. I said, Toby, I can't write. Why can't I write? You know, this was 3-4 months after I got run over. He said, because your body's broken and your body and spirit are one and they're both mending. And I think that's been going on for a long time. I mean, you know, I still have aches and pains and fatigue every day, but I think a new gift is coming. I really do. I think writing is going to become more what it was before I got run over than what it's been since I got run over, which has been like, you know, chasing a blowing piece of paper on a windy playground.
Well, one of the new pieces in your new collection, in one of those pieces you say that the best person for a crippled man to cry with is a good physical therapist. Have you gotten a new sense of what's best to bring to or to leave to a professional, you know, as opposed to someone who you're very intimate with, someone in your family?
I went to a professional psychologist in 89, which was nearly 3 years after the accident, because I woke up every morning crying, and one morning I couldn't stop. And so I guess I learned from that, you know, when you can't move, it's time to go to the professionals. What the professional did in 1 hour, though, was get me to contact 2 other crippled friends, and one came over 2 days later, taught me to drive a car. And so I saw this guy, the professional, probably for about 6 or 8 weeks. And, you know, he was very good. He said, you're not depressed, you're sad because you lost your legs and you'll always be sad and you'll never replace them. Which is exactly what all the friends I called said. You know, you will always wake up missing your legs. And you will never get over that. And I had made the mistake of expecting one day to wake up as you do from the flu and say, wow, that was tough. Now I feel great. I'm myself again. It never happened. So before I, you know, just lay there crying for a few days. I used to call myself a bad cripple. I was angry at myself for not being a cheerful cripple. Then I found out from the other guys who were more experienced cripples than I that they weren't cheerful either. They had just learned to expect to wake up feeling this and expect to go through this each day and night, you know, the psychic pain, the spiritual, the physical. And it's nice to have that brother and sisterhood.
You use the word cripple to describe your condition?
I do. I do, but I think that's because I'm a writer. I've never liked euphemisms. You know, I don't say passed away. I say dead. One of my older children came to me in the hospital and said, you're not disabled. You're physically challenged. I said, no, you're physically challenged. You're breathing hard from climbing the stairs. I'm disabled. My friends who are active disabled people like to be called disabled, so I call them disabled. But cripple is a good old-fashioned word for me, you know. And that's what I would have written before if I write a story about somebody who was crippled.
I don't know. I guess it was a year or two after your accident, you were separated from your third wife.
Mm-hmm.
And
1 year, just about.
1 year. And I was wondering if you've thought a lot about whether it was the relationship or the accident that, you know, and how the accident changed the relationship, you know, that was responsible for the separation.
Yeah, I have, and it's not too personal a question. It's just one that I can't answer because I don't have the answers. The thing is about marriage is my own and everybody else's. I always assume there are so many mysteries that I will never understand anybody's any more than they do. So, you know, would we have would we still be married if I hadn't got run over? I don't know. I really don't know. I hope so. I don't know. I know the accident did something. And I know that I've only learned this spring, realized this spring, just thinking back on myself, that I was a little crazy for at least a year, but I think mostly most of two. And still am. Things get distorted when you've been on your legs for, you know, nearly 50 years, and then all of a sudden you're sitting, you're always looking up at people, steps are always problems, bathrooms are always problems. Traveling is horrendous. It's frightening. It's stressful. It's helpless. You're always in someone else's hands. The access is never right. You know, the world is not curbs. Well, of course, the world is eating, drinking, sleeping, being clean, emptying one's body waste, and all of that has to do with access. So, but, you know, this can get very boring to listen to, and it's actually been a problem with my writing. I've had a hard time in fiction. I was writing a story last fall about a woman with, let's see, a husband and three children, and my notes were to get everybody up in the morning and get breakfast and get that done in one paragraph. I went, Terry, 2,400 words before I got him out of the house. And I read those 2,400 words to my fiction workshop that meets at my house on Thursdays. And as soon as I finished reading it, I said, this is really about somebody in a wheelchair. I didn't know that. But it took me another month or so to realize that I was spending so much time. There were some pretty nice sentences there, too, but it's all madness. I was spending so much time on that story because I celebrated her getting out of bed and putting her boots on while standing up, walking to the bathroom, standing up from the toilet, standing at the lavatory in the mirror, going downstairs, standing at the stove. I mean, you know, it was Ginger Rogers I was doing. I was choreographing. I thought, oh, my God, I've not only lost height perception, I can't tell how tall people are anymore, but I've lost the proper perspective for biped fictional characters.
Well, why not write fiction about somebody who is in a wheelchair, who is crippled? Why not? And why hold yourself back from that if it seems like that's what you're writing anyways?
Because I don't think I'll feel like I've gotten back until I can write something resounding about somebody who has legs. I think this is also the truth. Usually, as a writer, if something has really happened to me, I write about it in an essay. I usually write fiction about things that bother me about the world or fascinate me, but are not really very personal. So if I'm going to put somebody in a wheelchair, you know, I might as well just do an essay.
Let me ask you, is one of the great paradoxes of this accident that the accident has brought more attention to you and your writing, but at the same time it's made it more difficult for you to write?
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
André Debuse, recorded in 1991. He died Wednesday of a heart attack at the age of 62. 6 years after our interview was recorded, he was nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award for his book Dancing After Hours. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.